Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning, and welcome to the Brown Briefly. It is Tuesday, June 14th, 2022, and I am Gail Kellner. I'm poet, artist, former educator, and author of the recently released book, Hope, A History of the Future, in which I envision a peaceful, just world that verdant world that could arise after an environmental collapse. I'm your host for today's program, and today will be my last day on the Brown Briefly after, well, I was counting it up, after more than 5 years.
Oh, really?
Wow. I actually
My pleasure
joined,
having fun.
I joined this show in 2016 at the request of Brian Brown, our founder, and he and I and Truman had a great time.
Yeah.
I remember that day fondly. Yeah. Up at the old studio on top of the hill, above the former, place where Granny's was. So this is all for people who are islanders, you know, these, you know, when people talk about where things used to be, and that means something.
Yeah.
And anyway, we had so much fun. I think mostly Brian liked the fact that I laughed at his jokes.
Indeed. That helps.
They were always pretty dry too, weren't they?
They were dry. They were dry. Anyway, I've had many, many wonderful years on the show, and very grateful to my co-brieflies for the wonderful time. Towards the end of the show, I'm going to talk about what my next adventures are. But for now, I'd like to introduce our brieflies, and we also have two guests with us today from Australia, and we'll be introducing them as well. Okay, let's start with our sound engineer, captain of the airways, and pilot, treetop skimming pilot, Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Good morning.
We welcome musician, poet, former UW professor, bicoastal transplant from Georgia, Lynn Kerrigan. Watch out, her alter ego is the goddess Athena. Good morning, Lynn.
Goddess of wisdom, and she laughs at me a lot. I fall on my face most of the time.
Not true.
Good morning. We have Kevin Jones, our Clark Kent impersonator, citizen activist, rocket scientist, and leader of Indivisible Vachon. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Gail. Good to be with you all.
Nice to have you here. Joining us this morning via Zoom is Bruce Hallman, historian, president of Vachon Maury Island Historical Society, and fondly known here at the Brieflies as the Guardian of the Galaxy. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Gail. Good to be here.
And Bruce, you have lured two unsuspecting, innocent young people I see from Australia and brought them onto our show. Can you introduce right. them and welcome both
I
of them?
I will. Makes me sound like a salacious old man.
careful.
Which may be true, but let's not go there. Actually, you know, let me introduce Maddie Smith and Alex Smith. Same last name. They're not married yet. They will be soon, but she won't have to change her last name when they do get married.
That's right.
Yeah. But Maddie and Alex Smith are from Melbourne, Australia. They were students at Newman College that Pam and I met about 7 years ago and have become good friends. They came up about, well, pre-pandemic, they came and visited us on Vachon, and they're back for another visit, and they're going to take off later this week up to Victoria and Vancouver for a few days and then back to Vachon. And we've been running them around the island. They've been out kayaking. They did the Shingle Mill Creek Trail yesterday. Mm-hmm. So, Maddie, Alex, say hello, tell them a little bit about yourself and what you think about Americans.
Good night, guys.
Wait, mute them. Mute them, Truman.
Yeah,
I guess with the resident Australian, so if you need to know anything, we're happy to ask. We're happy to answer questions on Australia. But, yeah, Maddie and I met at Newman College about 10 years ago, which is, I guess it's a resident college on one of Australia's largest universities, which is University of Melbourne. A bit about myself, I guess I'm a finance professional, but I've also worked in education at the University of Melbourne as a tutor there for many years. So I love doing that. And yeah, just on holiday now after we had some of the toughest lockdown situations through COVID in Australia and globally. So yeah, it's good to be out of that and traveling.
Welcome.
Yeah, and as Bruce said, my name is Maddie, and I am also from Melbourne with Alex, and I most recently worked as a lawyer there, and I'm taking a bit of a gap year. I'm taking most of this year off to travel and just take some time off before I start a new job soon. So yeah, it's really nice to be back here on Vashon. It's a great place for a holiday and to catch up with friends.
Kevin, just a second. Maddie, tell them where you're heading after Vashon.
Oh, I'm heading to Iceland for 6 weeks. Oh, wow. After Vashon, I'm going to do an Icelandic language course there.
Wow.
So I'm very
excited. Wow. Now,
I'm
really curious about that. I know that the Icelandic language is one of the oldest languages in the world. In fact, they don't allow new words to be accepted into the language. What prompted you to be interested in that?
Yeah, that's right. I first became interested when I suppose I read about it being considered one of the most difficult languages to learn, and that I guess sparked my curiosity in it. And then as I learned more about the language and the culture and just about the country itself, I just got really interested. And so, yeah, I guess it's one of my favorite places in the world, and I'm really excited to go back there.
Wow, interesting. Sorry, Kevin.
I'll have to ask. This is kind of a cultural question, but sort of pseudo-cultural maybe. I had always been aware that a proper greeting between Australians is, how are you going? Is that still,
still
the appropriate one?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
How you going?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
Very good.
All right. Well, I noticed that both of you managed to skirt the question of what you think of America or Americans.
Oh, sorry. No, I forgot.
I'm going to let you off for a minute because that's kind of a big question. Feel free to let us know at any time. Now, my question is Vegemite still as popular as it once was in Australia?
Yes, more than ever, I think. It's great. It's a staple that you'll find in, I'd say, most Australian households, I guess, depending on whether or not they grew up with it themselves or if they're, more newer arrivals into the country. Maybe they haven't quite acquired the taste for it yet, but yes, it is still very popular and we both like it. So
it might be for our listeners who might not know what Vegemite is. It's about as ubiquitous as peanut butter is here.
Yeah.
But it is definitely an acquired taste, would have to say. What is in Vegemite? Is it ground up rack kangaroos or what is it?
It's basically axle grease.
Yeah. Now, let me ask this, though. Now, I've spent quite a bit of time in England, and there they have Marmite. Now, is that's a first cousin, is it, to Vegemite?
Yeah, I don't think I've had Marmite, but from what I've heard, they're almost the same.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
The difference is Marmite is meat-based,
right.
So beef stock-based. Vegemite is vegetable-based,
comes
by yeast, the yeast from the bottom of beer, brewing beer.
Right.
So basically very similar, but one's meat-based, one's vegetable-based.
Okay, well, thanks for that clarification.
Vegetable-based or grain-based? Are you saying it's made from beer?
Yeah. Well, it's made from the grains that you so that the leftovers at the bottom of the...
I got it.
Yeah.
So I guess it is grain.
Yeah.
But well, that's this explains a lot more about why it's so popular and why it's so ubiquitous.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. They actually do a thing in Australia, and they can verify this. When babies cry, they rub it on their gums.
Oh, that they do.
And so babies learn very early to like this awful tasting stuff.
Or not to cry.
So they indoctrinate their children early.
Now, one other quick question. I know in England they make Welsh rabbit, and they use Marmite. Do you folks have that also? Is that a staple? A Welsh rabbit?
Welsh rabbit?
Yeah. It's actually toast with Marmite, but it's a rare bit, but they call it rabbit. No, you don't have that.
We definitely have Vegemite on toast, but I've never heard of a Welsh rabbit.
Oh, okay. I just had to ask.
It's a trick question, because if you actually think you're getting rabbit, you will be quite surprised. I'm not sure in which direction, but I think surprise is the order of the day.
Yeah.
And it's not even Welsh.
That's right. It's not. That's right.
Okay. All right, Kevin, go ahead.
I've got another question, because one of the key questions that I was asked, because there was some actually colleagues from Australia who were living here on Maury Island for quite a number of years, and they were the representatives from the Royal Australian Air Force for one of the projects that we were working on. And the question that they would ask me is, what have you done with the bacon here?
Yeah,
I don't know if you've had bacon in America, but they were not happy with bacon in America, and they were quite satisfied with bacon in Australia. What can you tell us about Australian bacon?
I don't know. I think you guys kind of have the rasher, like the streaks of it, whereas we tend to more have the shortcut, which is like the big medallion type segment of it.
It never gets crispy.
Australian bacon is more like what we would call Canadian bacon.
Mm, right.
Yep. There you go. Much more tasty. I have to admit, I agree totally.
And it's not as heavily sort of mineralized, and it's sort of all the curing sort of stuff. But it's not as good as American bacon.
It's not the only question you can ask about what's going on in America with different things, but the bacon was definitely one of the first questions I got asked.
Yeah,
I don't know how it is in Australia, but I'm going to start our show a little bit with a little more serious topic here. I don't know how dependent Australia is on hydroelectric power, but here in the Northwest, hydroelectric power is one of our main sources. And one of the things that's been in the news recently is a debate about the removal of the dams on the Lower Snake River. In order to help the salmon be able, particularly the young salmon, to get down, as well as salmon as they mature and return to get back up. We even had, I would call them young islanders, but they're probably in their early 30s now, recently kayak, or in the process of kayaking the route that the salmon take, which I just thought was such a fascinating and interesting undertaking. And that was in the Beachcomber, if anyone wants to follow up on that story. Do you in Australia have issues with do you guys use hydroelectric power? Is that a common source of power in Australia?
We do have a bit of hydroelectric. We have a big dam in the New South Wales region, the Snowy Hydro Dam Project, which was probably established, be a while ago, many, many decades ago now.
The Snowy River Project. A man from Snowy River, the Snowy River Project was a big 1950s, early 60s hydroelectric in the mountains, the Australian Alps, sort of between Melbourne and Sydney, a huge hydroelectric project, similar to the TVA project here in the Appalachian Mountains, Tennessee. Mm. The other big part of hydro in Australia is in Tasmania, and there's been real struggles and real attempts to remove one of the hydro projects there, and they actually stopped a hydro project that was planned. This is about 8-10 years ago, actually stopped a hydroelectric project from damming the rivers in Tasmania, because Tasmania is much more like the Pacific Northwest. It's very mountainous. It's very green. It's much wetter than the rest of Australia.
Very interesting. Kevin, would you like to speak a little bit about the situation locally, or more locally, Northwest, in the Northwest here, with the removal of the dams on the Snake River?
The Lower Snake River dam removal has got a lot of attention lately, and for good reason. Representative Mike Simpson of Idaho, a congressperson, he was the first Republican ever to propose breaching the four dams on the Lower Snake River, and the purpose was for supporting fisheries. Now, there's a lot of uses of the river and the dams, and all the way from water storage, power generation, navigation, etc. But like so many dams that were installed years and years ago, decades ago, you know, their power capacity is not quite very good. And they were essential at the time for, you know, creating energy for businesses. But in many cases, those dams are not really very productive compared to the resources which are now threatened by them. In this case, salmon, and in this case, orca, particularly southern resident orca. The key thing that's happening right now is there's a plan to release a Northwest Dam proposal in July. And what we're now talking about is Northwest political leaders, including our own Governor Inslee and Senator Murray, who both hired consultants to look at possible plans to address the dam. Those plans are supposed to be out sometime this month. Actually, some thought they might be available this week. And after that, there's going to be a public comment period. And so for about a month, people will be able to make comments on the various options that are being proposed. And of course, the consequences. Opponents have mounted a very serious public campaign. Some say it's in desperation. Those are people opposing removal of the dam. People who support removal of the dam have been advocating for years regarding the fisheries and the orca.
Yeah, just to help frame the debate, my understanding is that those who would like to see the dams remain in place see it as a source of irrigation as well as navigation for the upper parts of the or into those upper reaches of the Northwest. Does anyone else have any thoughts about the removal of the dam? Go ahead, Kevin.
I've seen a lot of ads from the opposition, the folks who want to keep them. They have really got a big campaign going. So you see a number of those ads. My question is, did they ever look at the possibility of trying to add fish ladders or anything to the dams? I mean, is that a possibility, or is that just very expensive?
I'm not sure of the history of the development of the dams. I expect that they have considered fish passage routes, and I don't know how effectively those maintain the stocks. I think the concerns expressed is that the fisheries are down, and that's challenged by a number of different things. Of course, obstruction to their spawning grounds is one, but also, of course, climate change and warming planet, warming waters, and the difficulty of salmonids to survive. So there's a tremendous number of factors. But I think in general, fish ladders are probably helpful for a portion of that population, personal opinion. But I don't think you...
That's my understanding too, Kevin. Fish ladders can be helpful for the fish going up, but it's the fish coming down the river when they're young, going down through those turbines and in, you know, through the fall that they don't survive that well. Go ahead, Lynn.
I just want to mention something Truman said about the big campaign against the removal of the dam. I think that it's important to really understand that the advertising is not necessarily a great way to judge is this project a worthy project or not, because the people pumping out, you know, huge advertising campaigns like the anti-regulations against genetically modified organisms, that was hugely sponsored by all the food producers and packaging producers and all these people who have money invested in the status quo. And so it's always important that you look through a lot of sources of information to try to balance out the advertising heavy weight that's grabbing your attention on one side of that issue.
Well, it's like political campaigns. You want to exactly. see who's backing them. You know, I mean, I think that's always really important. I know when I look at the catalog that you get before an election,
exactly.
I always look to see who's sponsoring the exactly. you know, each of the comments. So.
And I think that there's inherently a difference between how people on the west side of the mountains here in Western Washington are going to view it and people who live on the eastern side of the mountains, just because our, you know, though we're joined by this river in a very important way, we have two different lifestyles, two different dependencies, two different experiences. And I think that creates the potential for not being able to see one another's side of it.
Now, it turns out that tonight, Gail, at 6 o'clock, tonight, Tuesday, June 14th, is a Zoom movie night and panel discussion around this topic. And the information about that says that the screening will be followed by a panel discussion of professionals with enormous experience in dams, fish, and the many issues raised by this urgent need. And I will read out the link for people to sign up to see that movie. So get out your pens and pencils, briefly, listeners. And the way to copy this down is it's a tiny URL link. So tinyurl.com/2p9yhtzj.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yes,
I will. I know the people are scrambling for their pens and pencils right now. Write this on your wrist if you don't have a piece of paper. tinyurl.com/2p9yhtzj. Tonight at 6 o'clock, for 2 hours, you can immerse yourself in the topic of saving salmon to save the orca and the removal of the lower Snake River dams.
And speaking about, you know, knowing our sources, who is sponsoring this?
I would have to look. I'm sure that it is folks like Save Our Wild Salmon are supporting it. Let me see if I can just pop open the information. I need to download the photo here.
You can share with us later too. It's kind of a
Here it is. It's the Lower Snake River Dam Committee of the Oregon Indivisible Climate, Energy, and Environment Team. So it is a environmental focus is what you'll be hearing.
Okay. Thank you for that. Lynn?
I was wondering if I could change the subject just a little bit to our guests and ask another question that's a little bit, if I can say, loaded, which has to do with gun safety and gun violence. You know, I always admired the Australians because you're as boisterous as we are. It's a wonderful party and drinking culture, and I know a lot of Australians that I've had, I think, some really good times with. So welcome on that category. But I want to know what your take is culturally on how you see the differences between Australia and the U.S. in either regulating guns or keeping guns out of the hands of people who are going to turn around and murder people. You know, you're very boisterous, you know, wonderfully expressive people, but we like to express ourselves with firearms. And I don't quite get what is going on with Americans. I mean, I know all about the Second Amendment rights and, you know, the kind of panic that's going on here about people worried their guns are going to disappear. So I'm just curious what your take on this and what your experience is in Australia.
Thanks for taking us on.
Okay. Yeah, it's, I think in terms of comparing the two, my view is that we couldn't really be more different. There's really stark differences in terms of, yeah, I guess the gun regulation and also people's views towards it generally. I mean, I don't personally know anyone in Australia who has a gun. It's not really something that people talk about or that you hear about. And I'd say the only time I would ever see one is if I see a police officer out in the street, you know, and I think they have one on their belt. But yeah, it's not really something that's very much of our consciousness these days. I think, you know, we have had some sort of serious gun-related shootings in the past, like, you know, mass shootings, but they've just been so rare that they really they did cause these shockwaves and, you know, create that motivation for change. But, yeah, I'd say nowadays it's just, it's not even something that we think about day to day. It just doesn't really come up.
If I can interject, sure. What's interesting is the Port Arthur massacre, 35 people killed in a place in Tasmania, former penal colony in Tasmania, really mobilized Australia to basically restrict large magazines, automatic rifles. You can own a gun in Australia, but you have to be registered. You have to keep your ammunition and your gun in separate places. You know, you can be in a gun club if you're a farmer and you're hunting foxes or stoats or whatever, you can have guns. But people in urban situations only have guns if they're in gun clubs or something like that, or if they're hunters. And they generally keep their guns in their home, but the ammunition is often kept at the police station. What's fascinating is both of these guys were born after Port Arthur. And so they've grown up in a culture that basically has no guns or not the proliferation of guns. And what's fascinating to me is Australia has a very similar frontier history
right.
to the United States. You know, I mean, the drovers and the bush rangers are very similar to the American cowboys and the American right. you know, sort of outlaws. I mean, so they're two very similar British settler societies with similar sort of colonial histories. And yet we've diverged radically in the way we have attitudes about guns.
And what year was that, Bruce?
I think 96 or 95.
Yeah, I think it was 96.
96,
But just from my observation from the US and the Australian differences, it's, I don't know, I really feel like for you guys, the Constitution is really, you hold that document so sacred and, you know, amendments to it are so infrequent that you know it's the document you guys just talk to all the time, whereas you know in Australia it's you know we're only 100 years old as a country and no one really references our constitution, and I feel like it's much easier for us to change things that the majority might want. And yeah, the Port Arthur massacre was really the catalyst. And it really only took one event for us to change. But that's probably the main difference for me. No one really talks to our constitution. And, you know, I think I went 18 years or something before anyone sort of referenced the Australian constitution. So, that's probably, you know, what I observe, it's it seems like it's harder for you guys to change because it's I guess it's written into your foundations.
I think that when we reference the Constitution, very often the people who are referencing it have no idea what's in the Constitution. and they use that as a shield, you know. So don't think we're all so, you know, holding that as a Bible, because most folks really don't know what's in it. So
it's exactly right. And especially the case law that comes out of all these various lawsuits that happen against the state, the country, and other private, like gun manufacturers, for example. Every time those cases are concluded in court, they become a mass of the references that have to be looked at in looking at something so complex in America. I like your style, though, that they just sort of, in Australia, it sounds like they do whatever is most practical and most safe for people without quite as much frantic deliberation on what we're losing in doing that.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's, you know, our, I just don't think it's as set as some of the things, you know, compared to the US, but just from, you know, talking to our US friends, it seems like it's a lot more difficult for those core things to change.
Yeah. If not lethal.
Yeah.
Well, we do, you know, we have, you know, there it's in this, it's the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights. And one thing, and I really appreciate you bringing this up, Truman, is a lot of people think about the part of the Second Amendment that says that it's the right to bear arms, but less regularly do we hear about a well-regulated militia, which is the second half of that amendment. And in other words, regulation on the on with regard to firearms. Lynn?
And Gail, excuse me, to add to that, I think it's important to remember that this is part of the actual case law debate that people don't have at hand to think about these things in a more nuanced way, because there is case law that was decided that said you can have an individual gun, firearm in your own home. It doesn't just have to be in a well-regulated militia. And so that's part of where we've gone since, I'm not exactly sure of the date, but I think it was like mid-90s. I'd have to look that date up and the reference of that case law. But it got more complex then.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bruce, I know you're familiar with how Australia made that change in the 90s. Can you talk about the, you know, how that roundup of guns happened and the political fallout that many important leaders took in order to make these changes, help these changes come about?
Yeah, I think the Port Arthur massacre it mobilized the country. And I mean, it was very quickly passed legislation at the national level to have a buyback program, to have turned, I mean, something like 400,000 guns were turned in and melted down. And regulations were passed on how to regulate. I mean, much like we regulate driving a car, regulate who can own a gun and how they have to handle it, that kind of thing. And also restrictions on automatic weapons, you know, large magazines. You know, nobody in Australia has an AR-15. I mean, you know, except the military, you know, not even the police there. The police aren't militarized there like they are here. And so what you get is a society, and I think Alex and Maddie can talk about this. You just feel very safe in an Australian city. You're not worried about a random shooting.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very weird for someone to say, if they're not a farmer, to say they have a gun. We understand farmers have guns to shoot foxes and those sorts of things. But yeah, I don't think I've really... even touched a gun, and I don't think it's just not a thing for people to have a gun.
No, I agree. You do feel just safe generally being in Australia, because it doesn't really cross your mind. I mean, it's not to say that shootings don't happen, they do, but I think it's really rare, or I don't think like a mass shooting, like more than one or two people, would really happen very often at all. So it happens, but it's really rare. Mm. Yeah. And it's not something that you're concerned about day to day.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Real quick. I just want to cite what I was talking about just a minute ago about case law. In 2008, the District of Columbia versus Heller ruled on the right to keep individual arms in the home. So it wasn't as far back as in the 90s. It was 2008. And in 2012, there was case law about the right to carry a gun openly outside of the home area to defend yourself away from your own property. So it's getting stickier and stickier, I think. But hopefully now, with some of the passage of some new bipartisan gun laws in D.C., we'll see if that comes to pass. There'll be at least some red flag laws, and maybe more background information and other ways of tracking guns anyway.
And there's also, I mean, there was a case in the 1930s when the federal government outlawed Tommy guns, for World War I, sort of handheld machine guns. And so there is case law of limiting large magazine and rapid fire guns. And that tends to get lost often And I find it interesting that the originalists, sort of who dominate the Supreme Court right now and who want to go back to the original language of the Constitution, mm-hmm. sort of have a mental breakdown when they try and bring together that well-regulated militia and the right to bear arms, and sort of they forget about the originalist language of a well-regulated militia. So case law has modified what those things mean. But if you go back to the originalist language of the Constitution and the Second Amendment, there's not much wiggle room. So there's a certain inconsistency in our originalist on the court.
Kevin.
Yes, yeah, the interesting hypocrisy, but I think that it's part of the game we're in. I do want to say that locally, the Vashon Gun Safety Coalition is planning to be at Strawberry Festival in July. And in the past, they've handed out trigger locks, and there's over 100, I understand, that the team has collected, and they'll be handing those out for free, along with other literature. So the main objective is to promote gun safety in the home, along the lines of what we heard from Australia of storing your ammunition and your guns in separate locations. Anything we can do to make sure that guns are kept safe and away from folks who may harm themselves or others is the objective. So look for that at Strawberry Festival this year.
Cool.
Great. Thank you for that. Thanks, Kevin. Getting towards the end of the show, and most of our planned topics we've jumped over, but I am going to back up just a little bit and mention that there is a plan being put forward for electric vehicle charging stations across the country to talk about some of the things that are happening in the United States. These charging stations are to be set up so that those who choose to have electric vehicles can have, you know, can travel with the assurance that they would be able to charge along the way. So they have to be within certain distance from the main highways and that sort of thing. And I'm curious, in Australia, what's happening in the electric car world of Australia?
Well, Alex can probably tell you all about that. He knows a lot about electric cars, and Tesla is one of his favorite brands. So,
yeah, thanks, man. I guess you tend to see them a lot in the inner city area. There's still probably a bit of Australia's a big country, as you guys probably know, and there's a bit of a range of anxiety traveling between cities or long distances. So. You do see a couple of charges along the road that connects Melbourne to Sydney. That's the Hume Highway. But they're mostly just in the inner city at the moment. But they are popping up for sure. Those in the batteries as well.
One of the important things, you know, about this, that they're doing right now in the United States, is that they're setting standards. And by doing that, you have a situation where you can expect to be able to charge your vehicle no matter what the brand of the vehicle, that you get a standardization that helps, you know, it's like a USB cable, you know, you want it to fit every device, you know, it's a similar kind of idea, is that these be spread out and that they be funded in part by the government and places that make sense for people to charge.
And can I just ask quickly, who's sponsoring this, or who's behind
the Biden administration?
Will it be a federal? I mean, yeah. Is this mm-hmm. a federal standards money. Or federal money to set mm-hmm. up the
federal judgment? Money fund? Federal standards. Okay. In order to get the federal money, you have to abide by the federal standards, which is an important thing.
So private companies putting in the charging stations is funded by the government, basically. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know a lot of the detail. Curious. There's a link
I see that. I sent to type it in.
So you can check that out a little bit in more detail. Okay. Kevin, you were going
I believe the administration, and my recollection, I'd have to double check to be sure, but I believe that some of the legislation passed earlier in the year, the budget legislation, provides for quite a substantial investment in charging stations, like thousands of charging stations across the country. I will have to say that I had the pleasure of going hiking a couple of weekends ago on the Olympic Peninsula, and the vehicle that we took transported three of us there and back, as the driver said, on sunshine. And the idea that you can make that trip without having to stop at a gas station, without having to pollute the climate. Transportation is like our number one source of climate pollution. We're working, of course, on getting the utilities to reduce their climate pollution. Right now, our electric provider, that's about still, I think, half of the electricity is from carbon emitting sources, but that goes to zero. Actually, it goes carbon neutral by 2030. So definitely go ahead and make that investment in an electric vehicle. If you do want to get around, the feedback I've heard is a 200 mile or more range is really a good benchmark if you want to go out of the city, like if you want to go to Portland. And more charging stations come along, that means that that mileage range is less and less. But frankly, the technology is helping to move the mileage range higher and higher every day. Mm-hmm. So it's really the trend that we all need to be moving towards. So hopefully people have that opportunity.
And battery charger, the charging is taking less and less time. There's technological advances happening in that arena too, that looks like, in, if not now, in the near future, you'd be able to charge at a station at about the same length of time it takes to fill a gas tank. So it's not a too long. Go ahead, Kevin, and then I'm going to take it back. And those last
real quick, I had always hoped when I started thinking about this challenge that instead of charging up your battery, to have a whole new concept. It's like Formula One, or I guess more like NASCAR. Yeah. You know, the battery's low, you pull into the station, they swap your old battery out, put the new one in, 5 minutes, boom, you're on the road again, or less, 5 minutes or less, right? But like apparently that's not part of the equation right now, but maybe in the future.
Has to do with the size of the battery.
Yeah, things don't all fit. We need that uniform battery standard.
Yeah, cars are built standard around the battery, yeah.
The standard. Okay, we're getting down to the last few minutes of the show, so I'm going to take a couple of minutes and share with you. I'm going to give you a little book report about what's happening with my book, Hope, a History of the Future. I was really pleased to learn this last week that it is in libraries across the country, Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, Georgia. I got a lovely report, a dozen others, 4 copies at the Seattle Public Library, copies in libraries in the United Kingdom and New Zealand, not quite Australia that I know of, though I think it could be down there too. So I was really pleased. The book has gone out wide, and I'm really, really happy with that. And what's next for me will be, the eventual sequel to Hope, a History of the Future. My hope is to write the next one, since I play with time travel and different possible futures, to look at one where we don't have to go through an environmental collapse, where we make all the right choices to get us on the other side to a peaceful, just, verdant world. So besides writing, I'm planning to dust off my camping gear, and I've got some trips up to Canada planned, as well as Costa Rica, perhaps this winter. I have a set of children's stories called On the Island of Here, Now, Always, Everywhere. They're parables for life that I've been working on, and I'd like to get those out, as well as my original intent. At about the time I joined the Briefly, was to gather all my poems for a book of poetry. So I would like to sign off today with a big thank you to our guests, to Kevin, who'll be our host next week, and to all of our listeners and my fellow Brieflies for the last wonderful years doing the show. I will become a loyal listener. And I have a final poem. Lynn, you want to say something? And then I have a final poem for us.
I just want to thank you for all of your years of humor and poetry and good perspectives on the world. I've loved having you here.
I'll second that. Excellent to have you back, Gail.
Yeah, thank Thank you, Truman.
And feel free to drop in at any time.
Absolutely. Doors open.
Great. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Okay. And here's my poem. I thought it was appropriate for you never know where life's going to take you. It's called Windy Day. Oh, windy day. I wonder what will blow my way. The contents of each day a gift from which we cannot lift the veil of time until it reveals the moments captured, then concealed, never to return again. So count your blessings along the way on yet another windy day. I wonder what will blow my way. Mm-hmm. Thank you all.
Very nice.
Happy trails, Gail.
Very nice. And we'll see you all, the rest of you, next week. And thanks to the folks from Australia. Really, really loved having you.
Yes, board. Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Really fun. And enjoy your trip home. See you.